Senior Focus. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Khoury. I'm your presenter for this edition of Senior Focus. And today we're going to be concentrating on the post-budget discussion and some of the issues that may impact on seniors and their families and their grandchildren. First of all, I need to announce that the 15th of June is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, and that promotion of seniors' interests and needs can be done in two ways. It can be focused on the abuse and the extent of the abuse, which is 10% at least, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of what gets reported, or it can focus on celebrating the positive things that are going on and the initiatives of age-friendly cities and communities. And this event that I want to talk about briefly is the Treasuring Our Seniors event, which is going to be on that special day, the 15th of June, which is a Sunday, between the hours of 10 and 4, and will be a whole community response led by New Zealand Police, with the support of the FOU Ethnic Board and a number of agencies and community groups. And so there will be stalls, there will be speakers, there will be activities, things you can try out, things you can discover, and there will be people with digital skills to share. There will be planning on how to age well. There will be all sorts of things you'll find of interest, and even if you think you know everything, I think you might be challenged and find that there are new things happening, new technology that will make aging even easier. So where is that taking place? Treasuring Our Seniors is at the Trusts Arena in Henderson, and that's a really large venue, so we're getting a site map and details of where our stall is. Senior Focus will be there, and we will also be interviewing people throughout the day. So I can only tell you that watch this space, and we will make sure there's something on the Planet website and in the Planet newsletter. Now, back to Susan. Susan St. John, welcome, and your background as an honorary associate professor at Auckland University, your specialist work in pensions internationally, looking at benchmarking, looking at evidence, makes you a very skilled person to have with us to make comment on this particular budget and what its dynamic signals and how it's going to track in terms of the country as a whole. And you have in one article talked about the country of two halves, and I think that's a very very telling title that we could say that would be useful to describe what how our discussion might tack today. So on that point, I just would like you to kick us off.
Well, good afternoon, and a pleasure to be with you. And you're right to pick up on this two halves aspect of where we're heading, because it was clear pre-budget that the budget itself was just going to continue down the path of ever-widening income and wealth inequality in New Zealand, to the point where we are separate and very rarely does one half really understand what's happening with the other half. And you get caught up in your own community and you speak to like-minded people who live in similar circumstances, and there's not a lot of interaction, which is very dangerous when we think of an ageing population and we think of how incredibly dependent an ageing population is going to be on trained health professionals, adequate mental and health assistance, housing assistance, transport, all of the things that make for the quality of life of the older, enlarged, relatively population are dependent on the health and ability to contribute of the younger generation. And to ignore what's happening to the lower half of the distribution of income and wealth, which are our young families and our key workers in the economy, seems to be very short-sighted.
And further to that, if we're looking at the strategic big picture, what concerned me was what was in the fine print, which was not really described very fully in the initial announcements. And that is that the government dealing with us being in a recession has chosen to listen to the lobbyists and do this huge investment boost, which they're calling it an investment boost, where they're offering this really costly handout to corporates and businesses of all sizes, but the largest businesses will be able to do the largest investments because they will be able to get 20% tax relief off every asset they invest in, and this includes commercial buildings and includes mining, drilling, very large-scale operations in the millions of dollars, and there's absolutely no cap provided in this wonderful handout. So with no end in sight, no limits, it's like a free lunch. And it really just is so horrific to think that we're going to be paying for this over two decades with only a very small difference in our GDP. And I wondered if you'd like to comment on that aspect of this budget.
Well, I agree with you. It's absolutely extraordinary that we could have a policy of this magnitude be plonked on us with no warning. I haven't seen any background regulatory impact statements, distributional analysis, what it's going to do to our current account deficit as people import more machinery and high-end cars and so on and somehow work out how to get entitlement to this, as you say, very open-ended, uncapped handout. And you look at something major like that, which it could have extraordinary impact in the wrong direction with so little detail, so little background preparation, and you contrast that with the mean, petty little things that we've done in the budget to save a tiny number of millions of dollars. For example, student loan repayments from a very low income base of about 24,000, and it's been like that for some time, but at one point it was increased with inflation. This budget has said in the next 4 years it will be simply frozen, not increased at all. So every dollar that these struggling families earn over 24,000 has an extra 12% tax on it. There's no other way to describe it. And the saving to the Crown, this $65 million over 4 years, which is such a drop in the bucket. But it's the cumulative aspect of those kind of changes that is really grinding our productive workforce down. And the student loan one is particularly short-sighted. And we hear in the budget too that university fees will be going up by 6%. And they went up 6% last year. And so people who are unable to access family money to put them through university will end up with ever bigger debts and be weighed down by those repayments, some for their entire working lives. And I'm thinking particularly here of women who need to take time out to have a family and so on, and might go back into the workforce after 15 years of being at home raising children, and their student loan may never be repaid by the time they retire. And it's such a disincentive. It's a disincentive for the work effort, and it's a disincentive to go to university in the first place. And it's not something that the baby boom generation had to grapple with themselves. They were very well treated with respect to the subsidies for education. I, for example, have had 13 years of highly subsidised tertiary education, no student loan at all. And yet the younger ones, we can do this sort of thing to them in the budget, and nobody really notices because it seems to be such a small thing.
Yes, and I think going back to the whole focus of the budget, that the fact that there were very few checks and balances of any sort applied, that only three government departments were consulted about what they were planning to do with regards to the costly handout. And if you compare what they have decided to hand out with what other governments do overseas in the OECD, this is a much more generous but also much more risky offering. And the fact that it's got no caps and no dates, no end dates, I mean, just a few very big entities could swallow up the money that's been put aside. And what happens then? Where's the plan? There isn't one. But what we do know is that where there have been other issues raised about how things are going to be paid for, thinking of the KiwiSaver changes and some other flow-on effects with wages for that, where KiwiSaver is going up, the amount of money that the government employees will be receiving is going to be higher. And so that's going to be paid for by cuts in public service and services, and agencies will have budgets cut, and the public is going to pay for this. And so it looks as though the same thing will happen with the corporate handouts when they start tracking up and the tax situation doesn't balance. They're just going to do more cuts.
Yes, it's a bit reminiscent of the Ferry decision. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. And for something like that, you really do need a very detailed economic analysis of whether or not the policy is actually going to achieve what is stated to be the intention, which in the case of this government is growth, growth, growth. And you would have to say it doesn't take much imagination to think of a lot of things that businesses and others would be able to invest in which would have absolutely no impact on extra growth. Either they were going to do it anyway, or else it's been something that's been encouraged because of this 20% bribe, and might not have any impact at all on producing more jobs, more well-paid jobs, and so on. So I'm not used to seeing these uncosted, unanalyzed, huge changes in policy imposed with so little discussion, so little scrutiny. There must be some background papers, and I haven't done the work myself to see if I could find out under the Official Information Act where they are. But it needed even more than that. It needed wide consultation, because whenever the government does something like this, it's at the expense of other things that it could be doing. And you're right that it's paying for its largesse with these mean cuts to things like a KiwiSaver, which is very, very short-sighted in my view. And also, I didn't mention, but should have, when we're talking about the impact of the budget on families, it's made a big flourish about a minor increase to the threshold for getting the full Working for Families. Just a very minor one. But it couldn't just even do that. It had to say, oh, we'll pay for it by upping the rate at which we claw back. So the rate of clawback goes back up from 27 to 27.5%. So that they're giving with one hand and making out that it's such a big deal. And then on the other hand, they're squeezing it much more tightly so that more people will be paying more back. And it is so short-sighted when we think about Working for Families is on a par with New Zealand SEPA. We have New Zealand SEPA unconditional income at 65 for everyone who fulfills very minor criteria. And people at 65 can work and get the full benefit after tax of their work. And we think about the equivalent program for children, which is the Working for Families, the per week, per child or per family payment that goes to the caregiver to support those very fundamental needs of children. We look at how mean and miserable the design is and how nothing is automatic, not like super that goes up every year with wages and nobody really comments because it's built into the system. And somebody on super doesn't face a marginal tax rate of 39% until they reach 180,000 of income, total income, which is an extraordinarily high income to face the 39% tax rate compared to families who on very low incomes, because of all the clawbacks, can end up facing very high effective marginal tax rates that make it almost not worth at all earning that last $10,000.
Yes, I looked at some stats that you brought out on the example of a single parent earning the living wage and how that, even though that's being increased to $28 an hour, that would give them just over $60,000 a year. But that last $11,336 extra that they're going to get was almost completely clawed away. It was 95.6, I think, in your stats.
Yes, and people are in different circumstances, and not everyone is affected the same. But the example that I gave there was for a typical struggling sole parent working 40 hours. That's a huge ask for a sole parent. And then to find that that last $10,000, by the time they paid tax at 30% and they've lost Working for Families at 27.5% now, and student loan repayment, 12%, accommodation supplement paid back at 25%, you can see how that all adds up. And then there's ACC levies, and of course, KiwiSaver contributions come last, and it's no wonder that so many people just find that they opt out or they go on a contributions holiday suspension because they just can't afford that extra 3%. And by not affording that, they forego the 3%, soon to be 4%, offered by the employer. So, you know, we've got a huge imbalance developing in New Zealand, a very short-sighted approach when we think of the scale of the problems, not just with ageing, but with climate change and climate change mitigation, and not just prevention. And we're not having the discussion about what is sensible in terms of that distribution. So one of the things that I think is quite useful to do is to think about the social security budget as it's set out in the full budget under the heading Social Security and Transfers, total of $45 billion. And obviously the top line contributor to that is New Zealand Super at just over half. spent on New Zealand Super. And then underneath we have all of the other things that are needed to support people, such as your benefits, your job seeker, your sole parent support, your supported living payment, and then the working for families and the Best Start and the booster for childcare. And then you've got the accommodation supplement that affects older people as well. Many older people can't manage their rents and need assistance. Well, when we look at those programs that are not New Zealand Super, and we see the enormous problems with the design of them, very old-fashioned designed, benefits based on having joint income, so that, you know, you don't even get a benefit if your husband's still in work and you've lost the job, but you needed two incomes to pay the rent, you're not entitled to a benefit at all. And you look at the impact of this recession on low-income families, who lose their jobs, they don't have any paid hours of work, and they lose also access to the full working for families. So all sorts of design elements amongst all these multitude of other support programs could be addressed if we took painlessly some money off the top of New Zealand Super and used it not to repay the debt or whatever some of the more conservative economists might want to do, but to actually improve the support programs and to have people understand that is what would be happening if we did do some tweaking to the income testing of New Zealand Super. Not to destroy New Zealand Super, but just to take it away where it's not even noticed it's such a drop in the bucket for really wealthy people, and use it to do what we should have been doing 10 years, 20 years ago.
Yes, and further to that, I heard that Christopher Luxon had announced this week that he was thinking it's a no-brainer to raise the age, and it seems like the tack that the government's on now is to expose this amount of money that's going out for super and say, oh no, we really can't afford this, we have to do something and soften up people to the obvious sort of low-level incursions that they want to make, like raising the age.
Yes, and it's so ill-defined. Saying that it's a no-brainer is quite wrong. And unfortunately, if we don't have a proper discussion about what the options actually are, we're going to get knee-jerk reactions like that. So panic, New Zealand Super is costing us too much money. We made a mistake with our investment boost program. It's going to cost too much money. Where can we find some easy money? Let's just raise the age quickly up to 67, say, over the next 2 years or 4 years or something. And we have to do this because New Zealand is in such a bad way and that we've got such high debt and all these other myths that are being promulgated. I think it's highly dangerous because, of course, raising the age to 67 is a very blunt tool to cure what the problem is. The problem is, if there is a problem, that we are giving too much unnecessarily at the top end. And if you try to attack that program by raising the age, yes, you cut it out of those wealthy people retiring at 65 or not even retiring, still in the workforce. They don't get it because they're not they're under the age of eligibility. But you also impose that system on a huge number of people who are just struggling to reach the age of 65 in manual work, or they've been made redundant, or they've been sick, all those things, and women, etc. And to force those people to continue to work to support themselves, or else spend even more time on very inadequate welfare benefits and run through all their extra savings by the time they reach the magic age of entitlement, I think it's a recipe for real disaster.
Well, it clearly is not an ideal situation, and nor is it a substitute for having a vision of taking people forward. And that's what's lacking. I noticed a few letters to the editor in the Herald this week have been talking about a lack of leadership, a lack of being able to say how important infrastructure, health and education are to the future of our society. So we've got a society that's actually united and that's going forward, and without having a vision of how we're going to get there and what we're going to do that's going to create that sort of society, we're just lost. We're going around in circles. People are being ground down, and we don't have any hope. A lot of people are going to be living without hope. I mean, we've already got the highest suicide rates for children in the world. We've got children at the highest poverty levels in the OECD. You know, we're not going anywhere.
Well, that's why I think what you're doing, Anne-Marie, is so important, because you're opening up these issues for conversation amongst the older population. We're often sold the myth that nobody over 65 would ever have a bar of changes to New Zealand superannuation. But people over 65 are grandparents, they're parents. They can see how the younger generation is struggling, and they can see their own future writ large in terms of inadequate healthcare, run-down health system, poor housing options. So if we can get the older population to understand that there have to be sacrifices, there have to be changes in the way we distribute our scarce resources if we're going to get on to even start to get on top of this problem and not slide further into a third world type country.
Yes, and I think this is not an easy discussion to have, and so I appreciate your coming on and adding value in this quarter. I also would like to invite you back later in the year. I'm very excited, though, that Marilyn Waring has decided to have a go at having citizens voicing their evidence to a mock select committee to try and give feedback about the pay equity bill that was passed without evidence to the House, without a select committee process. And I think a similar thing should be taking place about the budget.
Yes. Well, you would see some sort of a review done, an independent review, is that what you're thinking about?
Yeah, something like that, but something, a process where people can give feedback, because I understand with Marilyn's concept, she's got six former female MPs from across the House, and they're going to hear the evidence from people who would have gone to select committee had there been a process.
Yes, that's right. Some forum which could be independently organised would be a good idea.
Well, in the absence of quality democracy, in the absence of the normal processes in the Parliament, I think something is called for. But on this note, we have to end today, and we'll have you back again. So thank you very much, Susan, and thanks to our audience.
Thank you.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.